now. The magic is working.
Okay.
You've used the word magic several times. Now, the magic is working.
Okay.
You've used the word magic several times.
Yeah.
A lot of people use that word around here.
Yeah.
What is it? What is it about this place?
Well, it's essentially its unreality, I think. That was a time when there was a lot going on in the country. We didn't, we sort of didn't know much about it. We were sort of happily out of it. I never remember any drugs, apart from Dexedrine, stay up all night and do a paper. I mean, there was no drug culture. There was no significant anti-war culture. There was no, though I think, there were plenty of liberal faculty and sort of liberal students, of which I was one. I don't recall being terribly troubled by what was going on in the world. People flunked out. Friends of mine flunked out and got drafted, and you felt this enormous sadness for them. When they left, one friend of mine, one fraternity brother of mine, was the son of Lewis Puller, the most decorated Marine or soldier of World War II, I guess. Maybe Marine, I guess. And he came down, and he was very sort of nerdish, even more nerdish than I was. And he was in my fraternity, pledged my fraternity house, and was obviously very troubled by his relationship with his father. I mean, he just had not been the son his father wanted, and he spent a lot of his time just sort of playing bridge. I remember just playing bridge all the time and not doing much work. And he flunked out after our freshman year. We had a wonderful visit by Chesty Puller to the fraternity house on Parents' Weekend, which was joyous because he told us that, I remember saying that it only took, I think, 8 pounds of pressure in your hand to pull someone's ear off. So if you wanted a good way to get a cycle, and he had that burr cut, that sort of round sort of piggish head, and I said, boys, if you want to get a good psychological advantage, pull a man's ear off, shove it in his mouth. It's good for you. Yeah. Because I'm really just terrified. And so he said, well, I got to go to the head now. And he went to this door and opened this door, which was off the kitchen and near the sort of dining room. So it really should have been a bathroom door. And he opened it up and looked at us as we were still sort of taking it, and said, boys, you never buy beer, you only rent it. Ah, ah, ah. And he took a step, and it was the basement, in the cellar. And he tumbled down the stairs of the fraternity house. And we were all too scared to go help him, because we didn't know what. And he
pulled your ear off.
Who knows what? And he came back up, and he said, where's the head, boys? Down that way. It was terrible. So Lewis went to William and Mary for a while, and then he, for incredible reasons, decided to enlist in the Marine Corps. And when in his first battle, he stepped on a mine and was basically, it blew off about everything that could be blown off, and still had him survive legs and arm and fingers on the hand. And But he came back and he rehabilitated himself, and which was, I think the rehabilitation was worse than the trauma in Vietnam. But anyway, he did that, and he wrote a memoir called Favorite Son, Fortunate Son, sorry, and won the Pulitzer Prize 1 year, and then but he was all he still struggled and. He wrote me in one summer, I think, the end of a summer, and then he killed himself after about 6 months after that. It was very sad. But he wrote but anyway, in this book, and this is just, I don't know if this is useful to you, but in the book, you know, he talks about his youth and all the reviews said the reviews and the obituaries all said, what an honest book. And he reveals he doesn't step back from the full-length mirror. He shows the whole detail. Never mentions that he came to WNO. Mm-hmm. Never says he was here. Never says he flunked out. And yet he remembered to write me, you know, and ask how people were doing and what had happened to friends of his and so forth. But that was his was really the saddest case. I'm glad he got the Pulitzer Prize out of it. And he also. He also did a very noble thing on Veterans Day, whatever the year that was, 93 or 4 something. Clinton was speaking at a Veterans Day rally, and the veterans were heckling him and razzing him because he hadn't gone. And Lewis went up to the podium while they were heckling and said, he's my president and he's your president, and we're going to listen to what he says. They all got caught, you know, just a really wonderful thing. There's a scene in Roman literature that's a little bit like that. And I thought that was a wonderful thing, but I had plenty of others who flunked out, and what it made you so sad that they were leaving this wonderful experience, this wonderful place. And it simply was not the real world, you know.
Was anybody really cognizant or thinking about the fact that you were living in this very all-white place in a time of civil rights upheaval?
I can't on the one hand say that I was aware of really overt racism. There was in people from more rural parts of the South that I knew, racism sort of popped into conversations unpleasantly, sort of like a bodily noise. But then I wasn't nearly as aware of it here as I am today in South Carolina. Racism is just rampant. I think there was a great deal of sympathy with the civil rights struggle, which was still nascent. Dr. King was still alive, and so forth. But there really was this sense that Leyburn described of Athens. You know, that we were basically a homogeneous student body that. You know, we're here for our own, for purposes that we had always been here, and we're sort of honored by time. And Athens was essentially a homogeneous population, and so were we. And it was just certainly not to say Leyburn was a racist, and certainly not to say that he wouldn't have welcomed blacks in at the time. But I just. I am not aware of it. You know, we loved. You know, we all had black houseboys. I remember, and at the fraternity house, and we had a wonderful guy that we just loved, and he would take us to these black concerts. We'd go here, you know, these Motown people in Roanoke, and you know, these black. I remember seeing Major Lance at and David took us to that. I mean, we had a wonderful. We were, you know. just really close. And I don't know. I'm just I don't think I can. I'm aware of that sort of thing. Yeah, we were very much aware that there were segregated Jewish fraternities, and we, Phi Psi, my fraternity, my junior senior year, brought in a Jewish member, which caused some discussion. You know, he was a football player, and now I think he's somebody. It is John Wolf, who I think is now a big deal in alumni or something. And I seem to see fundraising letters signed by him or something like that.
I met him the other day. Yeah, he's the chairman of the alumni fund.
That could well be. Is it Philadelphia or someplace like that?
I'm not sure. I just met him the other day.
Washington Baldwin. But anyway, yeah. But he was the first. He was the first Jewish member ever of our fraternity. And I think that was where we made our gains in that area. But it was, boy, other houses would not think of. I think the southern houses, and we were basically a northern house, the southern houses I think were very opposed to having Jewish brothers. So that's sort of, yeah, I was sort of aware of that, but very much a sense that was. In order that people, you never heard the Jewish fraternities complain about it that I knew about. So
just the way it was.
Just the way it was, yeah. Status quo.
Now, one of the things I learned about you in looking at the Calyx is that you were a columnist for the Ringtone Phi for 4 years.
Oh, I just movie reviews, basically.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was very interested in movies. I worked up at the Lyric Theater for Ed's Side for about 3 years, which is a wonderful sort of experience. I mean, I sold refreshments. And Ed's Side was just really a great character that everybody knew. He was from New York. He was a little Jewish guy from New York. He looked like a cartoon of Nixon, sort of. He had that sort of prehensile jaw and always a 5 o'clock shadow. You know, he could never be really clean shaven. And he could bring five movies to campus, to town in a year. The Great Escape, Casablanca, The Magnificent Seven, One-Eyed Jax, which he would play four or five shows a day for a week, and Brother Rat. He would play Brother Rat in the week after W&L was gone, but VMI was still here. And he could pay his bills for the year on those five movies. So there's always, he got all kinds of wonderful sort of art movies and odd old things that he loved. He was devoted to the movies. And he was a wonderful, wonderful character. I thought he was just great. And very, you know, very, very warm and friendly to the students. A nice guy. But I just essentially reviewed the movies that were playing at the Lyric, which used to make Ralph Daves, 43 or whatever he was. He was an alumnus who owned the other theater in town, angry because he would give us passes, for the reviews, and then we never reviewed any of the movies because they were all Elvis movies, and you know they were all just these drecky movies. So, but that's what I did, just that.
And you were in the Troubadours?
I was in the Troubadours until the selfsame meeting of the tournament, NCAA tournament. A man named Jones was the director of the, this was also to be his last year too, but with the Troubadours, but he was the director. He was an enormously histrionic type. And I was cast in The Merchant of Venice. And I think. And I went to the, and I had it all perfectly coordinated between soccer practice and rehearsals and the games, and then the performances started 2 weeks after the last game. So I had this perfect, I was out of breath constantly, but I had it worked out so that it would go. And then it got down to, the season was over and we got the bid to the NCAA tournament, the top four teams in the country. And I just, you know, I said, I had to go, and I went to Ed Atwood, who was the dean of students. I was terribly troubled by this situation because I had to make a choice. I simply had to make a choice, and it was, I don't know if it was the Apollonian and Dionysian side, but it certainly seemed like the male and female sides that I was choosing between. And I went to Atwood and I said, look, I've got this terrible problem. And I, in good faith, I showed him my schedule that I'd made up. I did this in good faith. I don't, but now I'm on the horns of a dilemma. You've got to help me. You've got to intercede. I don't care which one of these I do, but I think it would be in the university's interest, since I'm the starting goalie on the soccer team, that I go to the tournament. Help me out with Jones, because I don't want to face him. And Atwood said, I'd be glad to. Certainly, let me just make a call. And he called up and he said, yes, well, no, yeah, which I know, he's got, well, certainly, certainly. Well, I'm glad we understand each other, thank you. And he said, he'll be glad to see you. So I didn't do a damn thing for him. So I had to go down there and face this guy. And he strutted up and down the stage about how unreliable people could be. And you know, we live in a world of perfidy and irresponsibility. He says, but the theater is no place for that. And he was smoking all the time, demonstrating a cigarette. And he finally flashed the cigarette down on the floor and said, because regardless, if I have to play every role myself, which I think was his secret desire, if I had to play every role myself, bang, he stomped out the cigarette with his foot. There will be the Merchant of Venice next week. I was happy to get out with my life. Yeah, but so I was in the tour, and then I sort of beat a hasty retreat. And then, well, then Lee Kahn came in, and I did some more. I liked Lee Kahn hugely. He was very nice. He helped us make. I was in Oscar Riegel's movie class, and Oscar Riegel was a. We called him Commander Riegel because he'd been in the Navy, I think. And this was one of the first classes, I think, in the country where he wanted you to make a movie, actually go out and make a movie. We talked about the history of the cinema a lot, and I was utterly into it at that time. And I was going to make a movie about a man being caught by a fish. And the idea was that a fisherman is out there, and he sees a can of beer on the shore, and he, you know, drinks it, and then all of a sudden a hook appears in his jaw, and then he's sort of drawn out into this lake. And I got a friend of mine, I prevailed upon a friend of mine to be the actor in this. But Lee helped us make the little sort of prosthetic for the hook and all that stuff. He was very helpful. I enjoyed the nice thing about the tour. There were a lot of faculty wives who would play with us there and so forth. It was lovely, but it was certainly a small operation. It wasn't like what it is now. But,
I'm intrigued at your obvious ease that. You knew all these professors on a first name basis, even while you were a student. Was that normal?
It was pretty normal because you'd ask the faculty about this, and they'd say, "Well, the students are just much more interesting than than their colleagues," and I think that was probably true. And I think the professors enjoyed talking to us. You got this real sense that they really thought we were interesting, and I remember they did an amazing production of Murat Saad my year, and Jimmy Boatwright played Saad, I think, as I recall. And there were other faculty involved in it, too. And it was a tremendous production. It was really great. But I remember all having dinner, you know, nights of the rehearsals, we'd all have dinner together, you know. It was just a matter of course. And I remember there when they built the new student union, then new, they had all the booths out, and then they had a separate room of booths for faculty. And the faculty were just furious about this. They didn't want a separate room, they wanted to be with us, and indeed, that's, as the Violet story said, that did happen. I remember Leyburn said he felt that the school was in dire straits when there were more eccentrics on the faculty than there were in the student body. He thought they were all becoming cut out of the same cloth too much. But some people, I guess, you know, were trying to polish the apple, but most of us just looked at them as real friends. I mean, you know, more intelligent, more educated, helpful friends. I mean, it was a huge part of the experience, absolutely without question. I think it helped to be, you know, being in a small town. I mean, the social life was very close. But you don't, you know, if you had a party, you invited faculty, sure. It was very common indeed.
And how about being in a small town? What was Lexington like in the 60s?
It was very small, very isolated, and I don't know. It was. It seemed sufficient unto us. I don't remember people having to go away a lot. I mean, people at Davidson. Davidson was a suitcase college. People just left every weekend for the weekend. They just go someplace else because it was in the middle of nowhere. It's only about 20 miles from Charlotte, but people would just leave. But, you know, there wasn't much of that here. I mean, you could still, one of the things I remember is you could still rent an antebellum house to live in. Sometimes in the country, as friends of mine did, and this contributed to the unreality of things. You know, you just don't live in antebellum houses with great staircases. You know, carved as snakes, with a snake's head with red eyes on the newel posts, so that the slaves wouldn't go upstairs. You know, I myself, my senior year, lived in the Stonewall Jackson House. It was owned by a man in Charlottesville, and my roommate, who was 2 years younger, met the guy, and he said, we could have it for $100 a month. We could live in there.
You had the whole house to yourself?
We had half of the house, the upper stories of the house. There was still furniture from... Now, this is above the part that I think is now the gift shop, sort of. But you had access to the whole house. There was still the furniture that Governor Letcher had loaned Stonewall Jackson in there from the old days. I remember this incredible dining room table that sort of went up and on a cam and cantilever and stuff.
So this was after it had been the hospital?
Yes.
And then someone bought it?
And I don't know. The exact history when all this had happened, but somebody in Charlottesville owned it, and we rented from him, and downstairs was an insurance agency, I think, some kind of business, and this was, as I say, this was not the whole house, it was two floors of the building on that side. It was all Stonewall Jackson. That was fun. It was magical. I mean, you could just open a door and just literally walk into the 19th century. I mean, it was terrific. It was a lovely place to be. So that, I mean, that made it sort of unreal. Unusual and magical, you know, to be able to do that. And it was unreal to sort of get away with public drunkenness and traffic offenses and things like that, because Murphy would come in and just sort of get you off. It was a wonderful, I think in a lot of ways, though you were learning and though you were becoming skilled, it was really, really a prolongation of adolescence here. Because you really were protected, and you were really sort of, you were cherished. I mean, faculty were not these distant taskmasters. They were like uncles or older brothers. And you had, you just didn't, you know, contact was very close and agreeable and helpful. You know, and that helped you learn how to act like an adult, being with those guys. So maybe that's why it was so pleasant, so nice. And then when you got to graduate school, it was really kind of a shock, because you got out into the real world of the '60s, and things changed in '68 when I was out. I mean, you had serious demonstrations and problems. '68 was a horrible year, but then. But then you realize what real working class was like, and what real what was going on. That there were some real issues out there to be worried about. So I think the dream was over. Yeah.
So why did it take you so long to come back? You were gone for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
There are guys here who we can barely shoo them away.
I know. One of my classmates came back shortly thereafter and is still here. I mean, I'm just amazed whenever I see him still here.
We have some very well-educated carpenters in this county.
Yeah, and you can imagine what Chapel Hill is like. Yeah, boy, they're all over the place in Chapel Hill. I mean, I had sort of had personal reasons for not wanting to come back to Lexington, and I think it was just sort of something. It was just a stage, I think, that I just wanted to get behind me for a while, and I'd come back a couple of times when I was in graduate school. I mean, I came back to, I was going to go to film school after I got my MA, and I called up Commander Regal and said, can I borrow, I had to make a movie to get into film school. I said, can I borrow a camera? And I got Lee Kahn's Children, and I got to use the church, the R.E. Lee Church, and I, you know, did all this kind of stuff. Made a movie here, you know, got into film school. I wound up not going, but anyway. So I did come back sort of shortly thereafter, but then, I don't know, just sort of moved on. Then they invited me back for something. And I was happy to come back, so I don't know. There's a point at which you know, your life gets so involved with sort of reality. I mean, I would come back here and say, this isn't, you know, I had friends who were living. I said, this isn't life, you know, this isn't the world, you know, this is not that. You can't live this kind of, you know, antebellum dream here that, you know, so abstracted from, you know, the problems of the world and, you know, race riots and all this horrible crime and stuff that's going on. And they would say, why not? You know? That was the end of the conversation, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of those conversations myself these days.
Yeah, it's a heavenly place.
Well, this has been really terrific for me. Is there anything more you would like to talk about? I mean, I could ask more questions, but I've gotten a lot of gold here.
Oh, well, I can just go on, but gosh, I don't know.
Any other teachers you'd like to talk about?
We all had favorites, and we all had, and I mean, there were certain teachers who were beloved, and for various reasons. I mean, there were people who liked Keith Shillington for reasons I didn't understand myself, but then I didn't do chemistry. I wish I knew more about Commander Riegel. He was wonderful, and he showed back up at my lecture last year. You know, and I said, I can't believe you're here. You know,
meaning
what do you expect? I'm dead. I mean, I thought you were dead. And he said, well, where did you expect me to be? You know, meaning. Did you think I would be dead? Whenever you see old WNL people, one of the names that always comes up is the name of Dave Fudge in history, who gave really just lectures of a sort that I guess I've also tried to sort of model, in that he just saw history as a series of anecdotes and made it all mostly racy anecdotes. And he gave a famous lecture on openings weekend, when you bring your best girl from high school, you know, over. And this is when we had Saturday classes. And you bring her over. And this was his story of the loose alliance of countries around Prussia, Germany, in the years before World War I. And this was known as the famous Cordon Sanitaire lecture. And this alliance was called the Cordon Sanitaire. But this was the most trope-laden lecture I've ever heard, because his my first year was his second year here, and his first class, in fact, was taught, he met in a chemistry room, and he was so fastidious and you know, obsessive and so forth, and the chemistry class had left the room a mess, so he was trying to fix everything up, and the bell rang, time to start, and all these drawers in this desk were open. And so he was standing at this desk and going like this, trying to close the things with his feet and moving like this. And his first words, everybody was just sort of laughing. We didn't know what this guy was doing. And he said, "You don't know how difficult it is to lecture with your drawers open." Yes. And that was the first thing he said, and everybody just fell out. And so, but anyway, he would give this famous Cordon Sanitaire lecture, and he'd say, "Here was," and he'd have a map, and he'd say, "What is this?" And he'd say, "And what is this? Is it Cordon Sanitaire? Who can translate the term Cordon Sanitaire? Can anybody translate this for him?" And some bright spark would always say, "You know, the sanitary belt." He'd say, "That's right, the sanitary belt. And what was the purpose of this sanitary belt?" "Well, it was to stanch the periodic bloodshed that was staining Europe at the time." We'd go on like this. Well, I mean, he's had 25 years to perfect this lecture now, so God knows how packed it is. But I'm telling you, on openings weekend, you would see them putting, in this little DuPont annex he lectured for a while, they would put chairs on the porch outside, sort of look, so people could look in the window at this lecture on openings weekend. It would be so crowded. It was screamingly funny. Of course, it would be immediate prosecution today, if he did the same. But his lectures were great, and he's a name that everybody remembers. And in a couple years ago, he came down to Raleigh to lecture to an alumni club on Herzegovina or something. Impossible. The place was jammed. I mean, people came from Georgia, because he was going to talk. And so Well, I mean, he was one of the real campus characters. Jimmy Boatwright was a great figure, who again really guided a lot of students into how to be sophisticated about literature and about dealings with people and so forth. And he was a wonderful, wonderful mentor and friend. I guess those are the ones that I was sort of aware of, that I took. They were sort of, someday when we write the secret history of W&L, there'll be lots of other stories to tell, but.
Well, the secret history gets less and less secret all the time.
Yeah, well maybe so, I bet. Yeah, I did a book of biographies of 600 American classical scholars, and I would write to people for information, and they all say, "Well, here's what you can publish, but then here's the side. I've got plenty for a secret history if I can ever produce it." Let's see. I thought this morning. I don't think I thought anything very noble. No. No, I didn't. I said what I think. Gosh, that's about it. But I mean, Labor and Lyles, that's W&L to me.
Well, there's one name you mentioned that nobody else has talked about, Harry Pemberton. Who's Harry Pemberton?
Harry Pemberton was a Platonist, and is. And he reveled a little too much in the Socratic method. And he convinced us that the Socratic method, as used by Socrates, was a means of arriving at the truth. But that didn't mean that the Socratic method, as practiced in our classes, always ended up with the truth. And he influenced a lot of people. And he was, again, one of these charitable, friendly, honest faculty members, such as you just rarely, rarely find. And he remained a friend, but he had a large influence in the 60s on people in my class. I mean, the two main influences, and sort of in my circle, were really Boatwright and Pemberton. They were really the people who students came to as sort of repositories of how you wanted to be, and you wanted to be able to argue like Harry Pemberton, and master the sort of gentlemanly dialectic that Harry did. I'm not sure it was always terribly profitable, and that people learned a lot about Socrates from Harry, but. He had a big effect in my era, and he's remained a friend who I've seen since I've been back. He just so thoroughly identified with Plato. I mean, he just his classes were not lectures; they were sort of Socratic sessions with people, and you could sort of argue and you often might feel embarrassed in front of the class, but you never felt embarrassed in front of Harry. In other words, Harry never he could. Sort of run rings around you, I guess, if you wanted to, but you always felt that he loved the exercise, and that's what it was about, and not trying to best a student. I have colleagues who just say, "Well, if I can just dazzle my students, that's all that counts," and I think that doesn't count for anything in my book. But Harry made you realize that this was something that could be loved, and that you would be a good person if you did love it, and that helped a lot. I mean, that had a big effect, just the way. And Harry, the other thing was Harry really lived it, and Boatwright really lived modern poetry and modern the life. I mean, he was very much into the life, editing Shenandoah and going to receptions and bringing important people down here. He was really into it, and that was really appealing. It was really attractive, and they were both very attractive people, so that was very nice. But yes, I think particularly in the 60s, I mean Pemberton was kind of the William Sloan Coffin of WNL. He was really in this time where everybody was questioning values, and Harry was giving people tools to do it, and so a lot of people became philosophy majors. It went into the ministry. That was a kind of thing that was done in that era, but I think Harry encouraged them too. I think he was influential. He was really influential. Yeah.
Okay, well, I see my little light flashing again. Any last words? Any last farewell?
May history just treat us all kindly. That's all I hope for.
Wow. I don't think that's part of my job description.
No. Well, and the
it's
the
part
Roman
of my
emperor,
nature, but it's not part of my job description.
Okay. Well, the Emperor Antoninus Pius said, "Happy is the era whose annals are brief." You know? And I think that's... The annals are probably fairly brief. It's the next 4 years after I left, I think, were crowded with incident and trouble.
A lot of angst, and well illustrated, too.
It is remarkable how well the identity has changed. And one thing I do notice is going, when I go to alumni meetings or to greet in Columbia, South Carolina, or Wilmington, Delaware, to greet people, you know, the freshmen who are entering WNL, how across the generations, everybody looks the same, and they're dressed the same era. You know, there's no sort of blue jean era and overall and batik and tie-dyed and three-piece suit era. They're all just perfectly the same, which is another way of saying WNL has really kept its identity, you know? And it's remarkable that it weathered the 60s. Maybe this magical isolationism, this sort of Brigadoon quality or something, has really helped it keep its identity. It sure seems to. It's a wonderful place to come back to. So that's all I will say.
Thank you.
Okay.